This is how they fell. This is from The Guardian, a British paper. This sort of thing has been almost totally blacked out in the American press. It's by Martin Kettle in Washington. It's titled, Florida Recounts Make Gore the Winner. It's from Monday, January 29th of 2001. Skipping down. In each case, if the newly examined votes had been allowed to count in the November election, Mr. Gore would have won Florida's 25 Electoral College votes by a narrow majority, and he, not Mr. Bush, would be the president. Instead, Mr. Bush officially carried Florida by 537 votes after recounts were stopped. In spite of the findings, no legal challenge to the Florida result is possible in light of the U.S. Supreme Court's 5-4 ruling in December to hand the state to Mr. Bush. But the revelations will continue to cast a cloud, to put it mildly, over the Democratic legitimacy of Mr. Bush's election. And listen to the numbers, and again bear in mind that random error should fall roughly along the lines of random probability, roughly 50-50. Some 56,000 so-called overvotes were examined in the Washington Post survey. All of these ballot papers were ruled to be invalid votes on November 7th because they contained two or more punched holes in the presidential section of the ballot. 12 Florida counties using voting machines where voting was by punch cards in this way, and 8 of them participated in the survey. Broward, Highlands, Hillsborough, Marion, Miami-Dade, Palm Beach, Pasco, and Pinellas. None of the ballot papers in the survey form part of any official count or recount. The research shows that 45,608 of the 56,000 ballot papers, or 87% of the total, contained votes for Mr. Gore, compared with 17,098 containing votes for Mr. Bush, or 33%. That's 87% to 33%. In 1,367 cases, voters punched every hole except that for Mr. Bush. In cases where the voters cast invalid overvotes in the presidential election, but then cast valid votes in the U.S. Senate contest lower down on the same ballot, 70% voted Democrat, Mr. Gore's party, and only 24% voted Republican. The disproportion was especially dramatic in Palm Beach, whose butterfly ballot paper interleaved two lists of candidates in such a way as to show Mr. Gore's name second on the ballot paper, but to require the voter to punch the third hole to record a vote for him. Though no absolute conclusions can be drawn from the overvotes, the implication that many thousands more invalidated Floridians intended to vote for Mr. Gore than for Mr. Bush seems hard to resist. The survey also clearly implies that some of Florida's voting machines were inadequate and that many voters were confused by the procedure. In the second survey, the Palm Beach Post examined 4,513 dimpled undervotes, unquote, so named because no hole was punched in the ballot paper, and which were thus excluded from the November and December manual recount process. In each case, the Palm Beach County Canvassing Board ruled that no vote had been cast on these ballots, but Democratic or Republican observers disputed the ruling. The ballots in the survey had been set aside for a possible court-ordered review that never took place. Of the disputed ballots, some 2,500 had dimples for Mr. Gore, while 1,818 had similar marks for Mr. Bush. If they had been counted, Mr. Gore would have had a net gain of 682 votes. This would have been in addition to a separate net gain of 174 votes from Palm Beach, which was disallowed by Florida's Secretary of State. Well, the Secretary of State, of course, in Florida was Catherine Harris. She was also the co-chair of the Bush campaign in Florida, and thus not entirely objective with regard to her ruling of the ambiguous ballot situation in Florida. One of the things that was most troubling to myself, and is something that I think should have served as a major wake-up call for people in this country, and that was the events of November 22nd of 2000, the 37th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination, in which the elder George Bush was complicit, and the truth about which may have been disclosed, or might have been disclosed, had the KGB report that was ostentatiously given to Bill Clinton by Boris Yeltsin in 1999 been properly treated by the American media. On November 22nd of 2000, two very interesting things took place. That was when the Bush campaign asked the U.S. Supreme Court to intervene in the election process, and I would point out that the point of law on which they were asked to intervene was not the point of law on which they ultimately ruled, which is a very creative approach to jurisprudence. But on November 22nd of the year 2000, there was a very frightening, or something that should have been a very frightening display on worldwide TV when a group of anti-Castro Cubans basically rioted, attempt to use violent force in order to force a recount of the votes in Dade County. The Dade County electoral officials stated in no uncertain terms that they were intimidated by this mob into stopping the count. Well, that mob was rallied to that point to a considerable extent by an anti-Castro Cuban radio station in Florida called Radio Mambi, which in turn was funded by the Cuban American Nationalist Foundation, headed up by an anti-Castro Cuban who had extensive experience with a Central Intelligence Agency named Jorge Mas Canosa. There is substantive evidence that Radio Mambi may very well have been set up in 1981 certainly at the initiation of William Casey, then director of the CIA and the chair of the campaign for the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980. Jorge Mas Canosa had more connections, as I like to say, than a switchboard. He was connected to, among others, Luis Posada Carriles, who had blown up a Cuban airliner on behalf of Coru, headed up by Orlando Bosch, the most militant of the anti-Castro Cuban organizations. Jeb Bush, as governor of Florida, had gone to bat for Coru and Orlando Bosch. Mas Canosa was connected with Guillermo and Ignacio Novo Sampol, both of them involved in the assassination of Chilean ambassador Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C. in September of 1976. That took place, and the evidence here is very strong. I haven't got time to go into it this evening, but that took place with the good blessings of George Bush's CIA. He was director of the CIA at that time, and the evidence with regard to the assassination of Orlando Letelier points very strongly in the direction of what freelance Danish journalist Henrik Kruger called the International Fascista, or Fascist International. These were the political forces that had lain at the very core of the worst elements of the American Covert Operations Directorate in the 1950s, 60s, 1970s, and early 80s. They had been deeply involved in the Contra support effort. People like Felix Rodriguez, one of the principal executors of the Contra support effort, was very closely connected to Mas Canosa. George Bush himself, in an address, saluted Jorge Mas Canosa, saying using those very words, "I salute Jorge Mas Canosa." This was the institution which rallied those anti-Castro Cubans, and a splinter group called Vigilio Mambisa, another militant anti-Castro Cuban organization, to what basically was a brown shirt action against the Dade County electoral officials on November 22nd of 2000, the same day that the Bush campaign and Theodore Olson, the lead lawyer for the Bush campaign, asked the Supreme Court to intervene. And intervene the Supreme Court most assuredly did. When it appeared that Al Gore might very well win the election on election night, Sandra Day O'Connor's husband was interviewed by Newsweek magazine, who was observed to have commented that she was very upset because they were looking to retire to Arizona and that she did not want a Democrat to appoint her successor. That would suggest something less than complete objectivity on the part of Sandra Day O'Connor. Antonin Scalia's sons were both working for the law firm that was representing the Bush campaign, both in Florida and in front of the United States Supreme Court. That would suggest that Antonin Scalia's views were less than objective. And Clarence Thomas's wife was reviewing resumes for potential Bush cabinet appointees from the Heritage Foundation at the very time that Clarence Thomas was hearing the arguments on behalf of the Bush campaign. Well, surprise, surprise, the Florida recount was stopped. And surprise, surprise, the Supreme Court ruled on behalf of the Bush campaign, basically appointing George Bush president by a 5-4 ruling in which the vehemence of the dissenting opinions from the bench were unparalleled, perhaps, in any Supreme Court decision. Basically, we don't have a president-elect. We have a president-select, just as Adolf Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany after the Nazi Party won a plurality in Germany. So too George Bush, not having won an election that was weighted in his favor and made close in the first place by the hands-on military-style operation, the multidimensional assault that I've already described. Even after all of this, the victory was not given to George Bush. It took an obviously biased Supreme Court. It took a violent action by a bunch of anti-Castro Cuban thugs rallying behind institutions that had been at one with the worst element of the covert operations directorate of this country when George Bush was director of the CIA. And this was basically what tipped the balance in favor of George W. Bush. This was, so to speak, the coup de grace of the electoral coup of the year 2000, and the lead attorney for the Bush campaign, the main attorney, Theodore Olson, the same attorney who had much to do with getting the Paula Jones lawsuit in front of the Supreme Court in the first place, which was how the BJ that Monica Lewinsky gave to Bill Clinton wound up being a cause for impeachment, or a potential cause for impeachment. Theodore Olson is now the Solicitor General of the United States. That is viewed as being sort of it's called the 10th Supreme Court Justice. John Ashcroft is Attorney General. And whereas two-thirds of all federal judges were appointed by Reagan and Bush alone when Bill Clinton took office, and whereas Bill Clinton has only been able to seat something like 11 of 64 judicial nominees in 8 years in office, two full terms in office, now George Bush is going to appoint the rest of the federal judiciary, and they are going to serve for life. It is almost impossible to get them out. John Ashcroft is the highest law enforcement official of the country, and Theodore Olson is Solicitor General. We here in California are experiencing a hands-on destabilization. This very large and magnificent state is now being punished in a fashion that I'm going to detail tomorrow night in For the Record program number 280. When I cover the California power crisis in considerable detail, I would note that George Bush's number one advisor on energy is Kenneth Lay, the outgoing CEO and chairman of the board of Enron, the largest natural gas producer in the United States. The Enron is a major supplier of natural gas to the California utilities industry. Enron also has experienced a 34% rise in first quarter profits during the last quarter. The price of natural gas has gone up something like 153% in California and only 59% nationwide. It may be 159% in California and 53% nationwide. But again, one need not be Lieutenant Columbo or Sherlock Holmes to figure out that there's something rotten, not necessarily in Denmark, but perhaps in the immediate vicinity of Houston, Texas, or some other municipality in the Lone Star State. I would note that Gray Davis of California was being touted as the very likely political opponent of George W. Bush when he ran in the year 2004, and that California has long been a Democratic electoral stronghold. Right now, that is very much up in the air. It remains to be seen whether the California political electorate is intelligent enough and sensitive enough and informed enough and judicious enough to realize that, in fact, Gray Davis is not responsible for this. The flawed deregulation plan was advocated and put in place by Pete Wilson. And I don't think one need be either Sherlock Holmes or Lieutenant Columbo to, I think, see in what we are now witnessing in California perhaps the opening phase of the electoral coup of the year 2004. But are the media talking about this? No. What are the media talking about? the scandals of Bill Clinton, because Bill Clinton pardoned a bunch of people, including Mark Rich, a commodities broker who was cited in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee report recommending that Mark Rich's use of the BCCI, one of the major vehicles for the Iran-Contra affair and for the arming of Iraq, both of them put into place, both operations conducted at the executive level by George I. Mark Rich was heavily involved in the use of agricultural credits through BCCI in the 1980s. Well, again, where the hell was Bill Clinton in the 1980s? He was in Arkansas. But this is all we're hearing about now is Mark Rich. We're not hearing anything, too, about who some of the people were that were working on behalf of Mark Rich. And it remains to, of all publications, the Wall Street Journal, one of the most venal mainstream American journalistic organs, at least print organs in the United States, it remained to the Wall Street Journal of February 20th of the year 2001 to report the following, and this is the only newspaper that I've seen this in. I have heard Bill Clinton, I read Bill Clinton's op-ed column in the New York Times, which was then roundly discounted by the Republicans. Wall Street Journal 220, 2001, right up front on page A4. This is by David S. Cloud at Dateline, Washington. Rich's lawyers paid for two tax experts' opinion. And these two lawyers are, according to an account Mr. Ginsburg provided on request to the House Committee last week, he was retained in 1986 by Mr. Rich's attorneys at the time, Leonard Garment, who represented Richard Nixon during Watergate, and I. Lewis Libby, who was now Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff. But once again, the Fourth Estate, the media, have not been telling us the truth. We are instead hearing about Mark Rich and the Clinton scandals, even as we are not hearing about the use of Enron and the cynical and altogether wicked destabilization of the state of California, the probable discreditation of Gray Davis as a presidential candidate in the year 2004, the possibility that we may wind up with Arnold Schwarzenegger as governor of California, because he's being discussed as a possible serious Republican candidate in the year 2004, in which case we may all find ourselves extras in Terminator 3. And yet, we're hearing nothing about this from the media. And I think that, by way of concluding the main part of the talk this evening, I think we have to contemplate the real nature of the forces that are now in control of the machinery, not only of the American government, but of the world. I think much of the work that I've done to disclose, for example, the Nazi heritage of the Bush family, their probable role as the American point element of the Bormann Group, quite literally a Third Reich gone underground, and the deliberate and, frankly, when one takes the time to examine it, evident program of political skullduggery and, yes, treason that brought George W. Bush to power in the electoral coup of the year 2000. And I think we all need to contemplate that, and I think we need to contemplate what is going to result from that and what we are going to do about that as concerned citizens, or we'd better learn how to get along with the likes of Arnold Schwarzenegger here in California and George W. Bush for another 4 years in Washington, D.C. And that basically concludes the talk for this evening. Why don't we take a break, and then I will take your questions up until, I guess we have until 11 o'clock or maybe a little bit afterward. There will be some other copies of Other Means on available here and also some other books as well. Why don't we take a break? I'm going to rest my voice a little bit, so thank you once again for coming, and thanks for your attendance. Thank you. Anyway, that hopefully, in a nutshell, will give you the picture about the campaign just concluded. I'm going to take a break. I'm going to rest up my brain and my voice and my lungs. And then I will take your questions either about the election or about any of the other substantive material. I'm going to give myself a bit of a break, and then we can the other books will be up here, and I'm yours for the rest of the evening. Again, thanks so much for coming.